Talk 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on with Marie Crowe and Ruby Walsh.
On 2FM.
Now, thanks to the two Johnnies for entertaining us this afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 22nd of February, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Ireland qualify for cricket's T20 World Cup. We'll hear from Irish captain Andy Balburnie.
We've played maybe 7 or 8 games in the last week or 10 days. So this is great that we get to go to a World Cup again in Australia, but there's certainly a lot more to do to try to get out of that group next time around.
In soccer, it's Champions League night. We'll preview tonight's action with Mark Langdon, who will also talk to us about Boris Johnson looking to take the Champions League final out of Russia.
Mr. Speaker, on his point about sporting events, as I said earlier on, I think it's inconceivable that major international football tournaments can take place in Russia after, as I say, the invasion of a sovereign country.
Plus, we've Gavin Casey on Kelly Harrington's winning return. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. I am delighted to say that I am joined by Ruby Walsh, who is coming all the way from Navan today. You're at the races, Ruby.
I was working this afternoon, Marie, for SNTV. Sunday's rescheduled meeting did play place here in Navan. And sorry if there's a slight delay. The Wi-Fi is not quite as good here as it is at home in my own house. But it was entertaining, if bitterly cold. Mark Walsh was brilliant on the Devils coachman in the buy-in hurdle for Noel Mead and JP McManus when he delivered him right on the line. There was a timely winner for Rachel Blackmore, Henry de Bromhead and Kelly Alexander when Brampton Bell won the Good Mayor's Listed Novice Hurdle. And Farouk Delane grounded out to win the 10-up chase when he beat Beacon Edge, also in the colours of Jigginstown House, stood for Gordon Elliott and Jack Kennedy, who was making the most of the rescheduled meeting. He was suspended on Sunday and therefore couldn't take part, but because the meeting was moved to this afternoon, he was able to enjoy a double.
Let's move on to news off the track, Ruby, and it was announced today that Oisín Murphy was handed a 14-month ban by the BHA after a breach of COVID-19 regulations and a failed breath test. This has been in the pipeline for quite a while now, a lot of talk about it over the last few months, but the decision was handed down today. Just in terms of what it means for Oisín and also what it means for the sport, Ruby, it's a long ban and a big fine, and he's one of the biggest stars.
It is, but I suppose, Marie, what it shows from the sport's point of view is that it doesn't matter who you are, your behaviour won't be tolerated, and you have to play within the rules or behave within the rules anyway. Look, Oisín relinquished his own licence on the 8th of December, and look, these cases were heard today, so he has a 14-month suspension, which is obviously backdated to the 8th of December, so he can't reapply for his licence until the 16th of February 2023. He got 3 11-month suspensions for COVID breaches and conduct prejudicial to the good image of the sport. He went on holidays in September of 2020, between the 9th and 12th of September. He went to Italy. Now, he put a picture of himself on his own website showing he was there, but when he returned to the UK, he went racing and basically lied about where he had been. Misled the authorities was actually the word that was used, so I'll take back the word lied. He misled the authorities as to where he was and what he had done, and that breached government guidelines at the time as well, so he got 3 11-month suspensions for that. And then for his failed alcohol tests, he failed one at Chester on the 5th of May, which he got a 10-day suspension for, and then at Newmarket on the 8th of October, he failed again, so he got a 90-day ban for that. So that's 100 days in total. Add those to the 11 months, and you get the 14 months. Now, he was also fined £31,111. I'm not quite sure how you come to that total, but that's what his fines were. And look, it is a very hefty suspension. He's 26 years of age, and he really has to, I suppose, sort his life out and get his career on track. The only issue I would have with it is the suspensions, whilst there would have to have been an investigation into the COVID-related cases because he had misled the authorities, the alcohol-based ones should have and could have been dealt with much quicker. And you would have to have thought maybe William Buick is the one who could feel aggrieved. a little bit aggrieved because that jockey championship went to the wire, and you wonder would William Buick have won it rather than Oisin Murphy had that 10-day ban for his failed alcohol test at Chester come into play?
Well, it didn't, and that is the situation that William finds himself in. But as Oisin is the centre of the story today, Ruby, when something like that happens to a young person in a very public sphere and their career is, look, is his career in jeopardy, would you say? Like, how difficult is it to bounce back from this when you're gone for over a year and you're, you know, you're trying to maintain your relationship with the relationships with the people that you ride for as well? It can't be easy.
No, it can't, but it reads and sounds like Qatar Racing, who are his employers, are going to back him. He will be out of the sport for a year, and that will give him a chance to, I suppose, steady the ship, get his life back in track, which is probably most important, and then he can go about rebuilding his career. But, Marie, the pressures on Oisin Murphy are no different than the pressures on any successful sports person in any sport. He's no different to anybody else in that sense. There are pressures, but, and that probably goes to the supports you have around you, the people that are around you, and the help you have. Now, I know he's living in a different country, he's away from home, and that's more difficult. But look, it's an unfortunate situation for him, but look, he's apologised for his actions, and he's taken his suspensions on the chin, and it'll be onwards and upwards for him in, what is, 12 months' time?
Okay, well, we will keep an eye on how he does get on over the next year. Like, what can he do? Can he stay involved, Ruby? Is it just that he can't go now?
Well, I'm wrong. He's not suspended because he actually doesn't have a licence at the moment. So he doesn't have a licence to be suspended. He cannot reapply for a licence until the 16th of February 2023 because he has relinquished his licence. He's not a warned off person or a banned person. He is allowed to go racing. He could pursue careers within racing in any other spectrum bar be a jockey. So he does have the opportunity to earn a living and he's very heavily involved with trading in horses. He buys horses and sells horses. He is involved in show jumpers. He will be able to do those things. All he cannot do is be a jockey.
Graham Gartland, former professional footballer, is with us in studio as well. Graham?
Hey, Ruby. I was just wondering, would jockeys have teams around them, as in agents and people to sort of keep them on the straight and narrow in this circumstance?
Well, you'd have your agent. My agent was my sister, and your agent in racing is generally the person who books your rides and basically tells you what race meetings you're going to and maintain those relationships with your employers to keep you riding the horses. Outside of that, Graham, no, it's an individual sport. And look, different people do different things. I suppose took a leaf when I was riding from Tony McCoy's book in that he had a driver, which was a simple thing. So I reckon if he had a driver, he had one for a reason. So I got one, and therefore would sleep in the passenger seat of a car and study form. But you also had someone looking out for you, I suppose, as well. You were buying a friend, maybe, or employing a friend. It's like anything, Graham. It's the people around you, who your friends are, and who looks after you, minds you, and keeps you on the straight and narrow. I think everybody needs that in life.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, well, I don't think anyone will argue with you there, Ruby. OK, let's turn our attention now to cricket. A little bit earlier, Ireland secured their place at this year's T20 World Cup in Australia after beating Oman by 56 runs in their qualifying semi-final. Gareth Delaney top scored with 47 as Ireland made 165 for 7 from their 20 overs, and that proved more than enough as hosts Oman were bowled out for 109 with 9 balls remaining. And a little bit earlier, John Kenny spoke to the Ireland captain, Andy Balburnie.
Game on.
Cricket.
Yeah, I think it was probably our best performance. We knew it had to probably be close to a really good performance, if not our best. We were pretty happy to lose the toss, I think, on a wicket like that. It was a used wicket that was really dry, and it obviously played into our spinners' hands. But I think certainly a lot of relief that this week has gone really well. It obviously didn't start great, but we knew that UAE were a really good side, and I suppose the clarity of having to win 3 games made it very easy for our mindsets and what we had to do. But yeah, I think we were all absolutely chuffed to get over the line today.
Yeah, because it's been tough going for the T20 squad, hasn't it, for the last while?
It has, yeah. And, you know, that it goes back to that night in Sharjah where we lost to Namibia. You know, it certainly took me a couple of weeks to get over that disappointment, having not put in a performance that warranted the game. But I suppose that, you know, David Ripley's come in and you know, since he's taken over from Graham Ford, he's been really, really good and positive with the guys and the guys have really got a lot out of him. And yeah, I think we probably need to play a lot more T20 internationals because I think that's the only way we're going to get better is by continuing to play. We probably don't play enough T20 cricket and Interpro cricket, but certainly having this kind of spell of games, I think we've played maybe 7 or 8 games in the last week. Or 10 days, so we've naturally got better, which we tend to do anyway away from tour. But yeah, this is great that we get to go to a World Cup again in Australia, but there's certainly a lot more to do to try to get out of that group next time around.
Yeah, you've got 6 months to prep for that. Have they put anything in place, or is it just a case of now getting over the line first?
Look, we have a pretty outline kind of schedule that hasn't really been confirmed yet. So I'd imagine that the wheels will be in motion now to make sure that we have the best prep going out to Australia. You know, a few of us have had experience of a World Cup out there and know how good the facilities and conditions are. I'd like to think that it might suit us a bit more just because they're good batting wickets and with a bit more pace. But yeah, we've got to make sure that our prep is right. I think our prep was good last time. We just didn't turn up on that final day. So hopefully the wheels are in motion for us to get good prep going into that World Cup.
Is there any talk or thoughts about bringing Kevin O'Brien back into the squad now at this stage? Feeling he was maybe missed in the series of games that you played in Oman?
I think the guys who have come in have done really well. I know Kevin's playing Interpro cricket this year for Munster. He'll no doubt be eyeing up a place at the World Cup, and that's great. You want guys to be competitive and you want him to push players for places. I think what's been really great to see is people like Gareth Delaney and Harry Tector stepping up and putting in match-winning performances, and Andy McBrien when he came in today with the bat. So good healthy competition is a great thing for all of us.
Andy McBrien seems to be doing all right as well.
Look, I know Cricket Ireland have their awards tomorrow, but he's certainly putting an early case for Player of the Year for this year. he's had an amazing couple of months, and I'm just delighted for him because he's the life and soul of this Irish team. He kind of, everything we want to do as a team, he leads from the front, whether it's in the field or the ball or the bat. He's just such a gutsy cricketer, and we're very happy to have him. And yeah, that was a special game today that he had, particularly with the bat, just coming in and taking that momentum into the second innings for us.
UAE have become a bit of a bogey side. You haven't lost, they haven't beaten them in the last 4 games, you know. Okay, so the pressure's off. You can go and enjoy the final, I suppose.
Yeah, look, it's certainly, we're going to enjoy this. You know, there's certainly a lot of happy faces in the team, but, you know, I think going home with a trophy will be even sweeter, albeit we've done the hard bit, and that is getting to the World Cup. I think it'll be a pretty entertaining game because both teams have kind of got that monkey off the back and qualified. So, yeah, that seems like a long time away, but it's only a couple of days. So, yeah, one more game and hopefully we can bring a trophy home.
And a quick one about the bubble. How is this one? Has it eased at all?
Not a bubble. It's been great. We've been able to go out and play golf quite regularly. We've been able to see friends and families who've come over to watch. It's just about being smart. I think like what everyone is doing at the moment, we're not kind of sitting in restaurants. It's too hot to sit in restaurants over here anyway. But yeah, it's just sensible and making sure we're doing the right things. There hasn't been any testing since we've been here. So it's been great. It almost, fingers crossed, feels like we're back to where we were.
Yeah, let's hope so. Andy, congratulations and well done.
Thank you, John. See you soon.
Game on. Cricket.
Now, that was Ireland cricket captain Andy Balbirnie speaking to John Kenny after they secured their place at this year's T20 World Cup in Australia. We're going to take a very quick break now, but stay with us because we will be chatting Champions League football with Mark Langdon and Graham Gartland and also be reflecting on the weekend's League of Ireland.
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM. With Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on with Marie Crowe and Ruby Walsh.
2FM.
Welcome back. Now, I am delighted to say that Graham Gartland is with us in studio. We'll also be speaking to Mark Langdon. Ruby Walsh is here as well, so we have a very, very busy show coming your way. We're going to turn our attention now to football, and we're going to start with the Pinatar Cup and the Republic of Ireland women's team earning victory today over Wales, 1-0 with Denise O'Sullivan scoring the goal. So in their Pinatar Cup, they had 2 wins. They beat Poland and Wales. They lost to Russia, but Vera Powell did manage managed to use 24 players over the three games, which is quite good preparation, because very, very shortly in April they will be resuming their World Cup qualification campaign away to Sweden. So getting to see what she's got and to see what players she has and how things are shaping up, it was very beneficial for her to have that tournament. Graham, just for the Republic of Ireland women's team, I'm not sure if you got to see much of it, but just in terms of even how things seem to be progressing for them, there's a lot of positivity around it.
Yeah, there's been a lot of positivity around the women's game the last couple of years, and it's great to see. It's probably just in time as well with the big games coming up for them. In fairness, a tournament away like that is great for the togetherness of the squad. You get to know each other, they're with each other 24/7, then the togetherness comes, and then when they roll into the qualifiers in April, they should be better for it.
Well, he now is a Shamrock Rovers team in the Women's National Senior League.
Yeah, I think it's coming, isn't it, Joe? We had a 19s last year, and we've got a 17s now this year, and actually Katie McCabe's little sister will be playing with the 17s this season as well, so hopefully she's the next one through.
Yeah, for sure. We'll be keeping an eye on it, because I think having a club like Shamrock Rovers in the Women's National League Senior would do an awful lot just even for the promotion and interest in the domestic league. Right, let us turn our attention to the Champions League final. So a little bit earlier, Boris Johnson said that Russia should be stripped of hosting this season's Champions League final in St. Petersburg. He was speaking in the House of Commons. Let's hear from him.
Can I confirm what I think he implied in an answer to a previous question, that he will push for this year's Champions League final to be moved from St. Petersburg?
Mr. Speaker, on his point about sporting events, as I said earlier on, I think it inconceivable that major international football tournaments can take place in Russia after, as I say, the invasion of a sovereign country.
Mark Langdon of the Racing Post joins us now. Mark, that clip is garnering quite a lot of attention. And you know, when sport crosses into the political sphere, that there's something serious happening in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, UEFA tend not to... They try to stay out of politics as much as they possibly can. And there are occasions when it's impossible for them to stand aside. I mean, Boris Johnson is not the only sort of prime minister or leader of a country that has, you know, called for, you know, the Champions League to be taken away from Russia. I think UEFA are under increasing pressure to make that decision very soon. They have tried, you know, to, again, give it time, but I'm not sure that they can allow this situation to go on for too much longer. And I you know, often don't always agree with what Boris Johnson says, but I mean, it does feel inconceivable at this stage anyway for something as, you know, a high profile an event as that to take place in Russia at the moment.
Mark, we are into the round of 16, so this tournament is progressing. How soon will UEFA have to make a decision, find a new host city, new stadium? There's going to be, I know we don't know who's going to be in the final, but you're still going to have things like airlines, trains, hotels, etc. It's not just that simple to move an event like the Champions League final.
It's not, no. You know, and particularly, you know, from the whole kind of UEFA family, again, not something that I always like to talk about, really. The hangers-on with UEFA, they all like to go to the final. There's a lot of events that kind of take place around the Champions League final, around sponsorship. And, of course, you know, that's a big part of how the money is pumped into the competition. There has been a suggestion that they will try to leave it you know, some while before, even if they announced that Russia won't be hosting it, to see who's in the final. I suppose, you know, if it were to be, let's say, two English teams, then Wembley would feel like the obvious choice. Whether they can let it sort of go that long, though, I don't think they will. But I suspect that they'll at least try to give it this round and then maybe look at the quarterfinal draw and then see where they're at. But I do agree, Ruby, that it's not just as simple as sort of, you know, 2-3 weeks before the Champions League final they suddenly pluck a venue out of somewhere. That, you know, that can't happen just because of the whole corporate stuff that goes with an event like the Champions League final.
There must be a few sporting events that are under threat. Even the Republic of Ireland's trip to Ukraine on June 14th, Jonathan Hill said last week that he wouldn't be surprised if UEFA do decide to move it away from Kiev to a neutral country. So I'd imagine there's probably a few other associations as well who have sporting fixtures scheduled for areas that probably aren't the safest to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got one coming up next month, the World Cup playoff, Russia against Poland. Poland have asked for that game to be moved. You would assume that it would be. And it's always, I suppose, in situations like this, there is the argument for, you know, you really are punishing kind of sports teams and sort of athletes that have done, you know, very little or nothing wrong in these incidents. But at the same time, I think the governing body has to be seen to be doing something, you know, whether that be as punishment or just for the safety of everyone, really. And you wouldn't, if you're Poland playing that World Cup playoff tie, I mean, you wouldn't really want to be going to Russia to play that game at the moment, would you? So I think it will have to be moved away to a sort of very worst, I think, a neutral venue. I don't think they'd sort of switch it around and sort of, you know, just make Russia play away as such. But I do think it will have to be played at a neutral venue for sure.
Well, Mark, we have to get through tonight's round first before we wonder about what's going to happen to the final. But obviously Chelsea play Lille tonight. Chelsea have lost once in the last 17 games in all cup ties. Look, they've been around the world lately. They're probably not even sure what competition they're playing in themselves in the Premier League, the FA Cup, the World Club Cup. But this should be too good for Lille, won't they?
I would have thought so. I mean, they really lucked out in the draw, Chelsea, because if you remember, they finished second in their group and managed to draw the weakest of the group winners. So they managed to play Lille. Then they had to do a redraw because they messed up the draw and they got Lille again. So the gods were definitely smiling on Chelsea in terms of that Champions League draw. I think it has been a really difficult few months for Thomas Tuchel. He's had to deal with a lot of they've had a lot of COVID in the camp. They've also had just injuries. And then, as you say there, Ruby, a lot of matches in different competitions. And I think they struggled to focus. You know, they had the two-legged tie against Tottenham as well in the EFL Cup. They've got the cup final on Sunday for that. And I don't think it's helped the players in terms of sort of finding a rhythm, whether it's by choice or whether it's been forced. But Tuchel is having to rotate his players around a lot. And you know, there's been a lot of criticism of Romelu Lukaku's performances in that remarkable game on Saturday when he only had 7 touches against Crystal Palace. But in some kind of defence, you can't defend it totally, but in some defence, I do wonder kind of what sort of the best front three is for Chelsea. And I'm not even sure the manager knows at the moment what his best team is. And he's just constantly moving players around to try to find the right rhythm for them. You know, but they are a team, as you mentioned there with the stats, that are very good in one-off cup ties. And even though they don't arrive in, say, the same kind of form as Liverpool or City or maybe even Bayern Munich in terms of the teams that are fancy to win it, I still think it's going to take a good one to beat them just because of how solid they are defensively, and cup football seems to be made for them.
Well, Mark mentioned there that Lukaku only had 7 touches against Palace at the weekend, a record low in the Premier League. And unsurprisingly, Thomas Tuchel was asked about this, and here's what he had to say.
It's sometimes like this with strikers. If they struggle a bit in self-confidence, if they struggle a little bit to find the space and to get involved against a good defensive side, it can be like this. And this is of course not what we want, and of course not what Romelu wants. But it's also not like it's not the time to laugh about him and make jokes about him. He is in the spotlight, of course, and we will protect him because he's our player.
Yeah, look, it's definitely a difficult time for any player if they have a record like that, Graham. But what's going on here? Lukaku was touted as being that missing jigsaw piece for Chelsea, to that he was the type of player that they would need to get the goals that they were after. Is it just a case that Thomas Tuchel isn't playing a system that suits Lukaku?
I think last season they looked and said that they needed a focal point that they could get runners off. So obviously Lukaku comes towards the ball, he links the play, and they're looking at their two wide men to run beyond and bring length to the game, and he'd be the key man down the middle, hopefully to get on the end of crosses then once they get into wide areas. But I always feel with strikers sometimes to get themselves into the game, they have to initiate the movement and look to be wanting to receive the ball a little bit more, and if I put my head up and see a striker making a run, I'll go off what he wants in that situation, and sometimes think he's waiting to see what the defenders are going to do or his midfielders are going to do, and then it's more of a reaction. But yeah, he was touted as being the one that would change Chelsea and turn them into a title contender. It hasn't worked out for every reason. Some of it, I think, is on Lukaku in terms of bringing attention to himself a couple of months ago with the article he done. And what happens is that erodes the trust in him from Tuchel's point of view, and also from the other players that he's probably speaking out of school around the squad. So he has to work his way back in. He has to work his way back in terms of trust, and he also has to work his way back in terms of performances for the team. But he is a handful, and you don't go from what he done last year with Inter Milan and winning the league with them to suddenly becoming a bad player overnight. But sometimes I think these players need to work things through themselves and get themselves out the other side of it, and if Tuchel can help that, then great. But I do probably think it's the onus is on Lukaku to maybe pull himself out of a rut.
It would look that way anyway. But Mark, obviously this is the first year with no away goals at this stage of the competition. Did you notice any difference in how the home team played in the weekend, in the legs last weekend and the weekend, or last week and the week before?
I didn't know. I think away teams scored in all three competitions, Champions League, Europa League, Europa Conference, away teams scored 1.55 goals away from home, which I think is a pretty steady return, really. There was the one high-profile game, Real Madrid against Paris Saint-Germain, where Real Madrid barely had a shot. And you know, maybe they were the exception to that rule, and they got heavily criticised in Spain for their performance. I'm not sure whether they played that way because the away goal rule is no longer in operation, or just whether they just played badly and Paris suffocated them, played quite well. And I also think that Benzema wasn't fully fit, and so that took a lot out of Real Madrid's attack. I think it'll be interesting. We need to see more evidence. Clearly you can't just go on sort of one set of fixtures before you start making sweeping judgments either way. I tend to think now that in the high-profile teams, nearly all of them play on the front foot, whether they're home or away now, and they just try to win matches. So I'm hoping that it doesn't turn into a bit of a bore fest. But the tension, that first leg tension that you used to get, has just slightly disappeared, with particularly for the home team. There's not as much panic, I don't think, around the home team, you know, desperate not to concede a goal.
And just on Lille, Graham, because haven't really spoken about them that much, and still they did all right in their group stages, top in their group, but albeit against maybe lesser opposition than some of the other groups had to face. Do you think they have enough talent? Because, you know, they have some youth, they have some veterans, they have some Premier League cast-offs as well, who would only relish the chance to take on Chelsea.
I think especially at home as well, they seem to generate and create an atmosphere there. We were looking at it beforehand, they lost a manager that probably brought them to the title last year. Now, to win a title ahead of Paris Saint-Germain in the French league is no mean feat, but they've lost their manager Galtier to Nice, and I think a lot of key players went as well. They're sitting 11th in the French league, so like you said, in a one-off game they might be able to beat Chelsea, but over the two games I fancy Chelsea be strong enough to go through. It'd be interesting to see what they can take back to France and see if they can have a go at them in the home leg. But like you said, with the away goals not coming into play, it'd be interesting to see how the games are treated over in the quarterfinals.
Mark, I have read where there is some interest around Jonathan David, the 22-year-old Canadian striker who plays for Lille. Do you know much about him?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's done very well for Canada. They're going to be qualifying for the World Cup, so we're going to see him in the World Cup. He's quick. I suppose the one issue you've got really is that you know, he's not going to get much of the ball tonight against Chelsea, and Chelsea don't leave that much space in behind, so probably negating sort of one of his main strengths, really. And, you know, there isn't a huge amount of creativity in that Lille side either. So I think, not because he's a bad player, I think he might struggle tonight just because lack of service, lack of quality, lack of possession, all the things really that, you know, can happen when you're an underdog team. But I've got little doubt that he will move on in the summer. There's a lot of hype around him, has been linked with the likes of Arsenal. You could see somebody like Arsenal coming in for him, I think, because, you know, they are looking very much in terms of their transfer policy at buying young players that they think they can develop, and they obviously need a striker with Aubameyang leaving. So I'm interested to see how he plays. And then at the back, Sven Botman, the centre-half, been linked with Newcastle. You know, apparently Lille turned down 50 million bid for him from Newcastle, just on the end of the transfer window. He's been watched by a lot of the kind of big European clubs. There's a question mark about his pace, or rather lack of it. So this will be an interesting test for him if it is up against Lukaku, just to see how he deals with an elite forward, albeit one that's not maybe in top form at the moment, because, like I say, there's a lot of European clubs watching Botman. So I'm very interested to see how he deals with this step up in quality.
So that Chelsea-Lille game is on RT2 television tonight, and it kicks off at 8 o'clock. Graham, the other game tonight is Villarreal against Juventus. Juventus looking for their first Champions League title since 1996. When you think back to those teams and the players that they had back then, I know that they probably inspired an awful lot of footballers, because we could actually see a lot of Italian football on the telly as well. It just doesn't feel like they have that same aura at all about them.
No, and even though in the last couple of years, obviously Ronaldo leaving as well, but when they were sort of romping all the Serie A, and then I think they got to a final, didn't they, a couple of years ago, and they lost. Ronaldo scored the overhead, and there was other moments where you think they're coming, but they've never been able to really, as dominant as they were domestically, it's never really spread into the European competitions for them. For such a big club, they're massive, like they're probably the biggest club in Italy and the most successful club in Italy, but it hasn't really transferred over to the European market for them. And they're in a, like you said, they're in a sort of a strange phase at the minute, where they've a lot of older players coming to the end, which they always seem to resurrect careers with them. Like, I know Buffon went back as well, didn't he, at some stage, and then he moved on to Parma. So it'd be interesting to see how they do. They've done well, obviously, to come out of a group, but you expect that. Villarreal are obviously a different kettle of fish. Unai Emery has a really good record in Europe. I think they're coming in as Europa League champions as well. Is that how they qualified? But they're in the top four in the league in Spain as well. They just come off a domestic win, 4-1 against Granada, so it makes for an interesting game. But I just can't see Juventus having enough to go all the way and win the competition. I think the English side will be too strong for them.
That game you're referring to was the 2017 Champions League final. Real Madrid beat Juve 4-1.
There you go.
Is right. And Mark, obviously tomorrow night, Atletico Madrid versus Man United, Benfica versus Ajax. We'll start with United. What will they be hoping for away to Atletico tomorrow night?
I think they'll be hoping that Atletico play like they have done for virtually all of this season. They won 3-0 at the weekend. I saw the game against Osasuna. It was never, ever a 3-0 victory. They only had five shots. I'm not talking about five shots on target. They literally had five shots in the game and won 3-0. Normally, you'd need to, you know, have much more sort of attacking threat than that to win by a 3-0 scoreline. Jan Oblak, their goalkeeper, one of the best in the world, you know, I would have said before the start of this season, has had an absolute shocking campaign. His sort of save rate is the second worst in the whole of sort of Europe's top five leagues, which for a goalkeeper, like I say, that was seen as one of the best in the world. Just, I don't know if it's a confidence thing or if he's just lost his form and he's never going to get it back. I just don't know. But Atletico are not that kind of team that we've come to not loving. You don't love them, but you have to respect the way that they kind of go about it. They're just not that team anymore. They've still got, you know, spiky characters like Luis Suarez up front, who scored from about 35, 40 yards at the weekend. Very similar goal to one he got against Norwich a few years ago. But look, Manchester United are not in great sort of shape either, really. But I think this is a very balanced tie. I'll probably just go for Atletico because of the inconsistencies with Manchester United, but I'd say it's a lot closer than what you'd ordinarily expect an Atletico United game to be.
Manchester United, though, will be coming in filled with confidence after coming through a very tough battle against Leeds and earning that 4-2 victory. Ralph Rangnick was speaking about it and how much of a recovery his players are going to need.
Well, in Champions League, you need to perform on the highest possible level in all those areas that you just mentioned. Of course, we had a game on Sunday, a very physical one. Atletico played away at Osasuna on Saturday, so there might be a slight advantage with regard to recovery on their side, but we obviously made sure that the players could recover in the last 2 days, and maybe we will have some fresh legs on the pitch. We will see tomorrow. And obviously, yeah, we need to play tactically on a high level, physically, mentally. We need to be prepared for a very emotional, if not even hostile atmosphere in that stadium. Some of our players will not be received with a red carpet, obviously. So, yeah, this is what we're all aware of. But I think we have enough experience in the team and, on the other hand, also enough talented young players. I think the mix of those two groups is perfect. And we're looking forward to that game. This is why we're all here and why we love this ball game, in order to play like in stadiums like tomorrow and then in 2 weeks when we have the second leg to play at Old Trafford. For tomorrow, it's about getting the best possible result. I don't think that the game and the fixture will be decided tomorrow. It will be decided in the second leg at Old Trafford.
Ralph Rangnick there speaking about Manchester United. They probably couldn't really get a better game, Graham, heading into this one. I know that Atletico aren't the side that they were maybe in the past, but they still have spiky characters and they're still able to bring their game to a certain level and will probably pose a kind of a different challenge for Manchester United.
Yeah, I think you've seen it against Liverpool in the last couple of years. They have a game plan that they stick to, and they try and frustrate the opposition would be the biggest thing. They can take their time over certain things. They're always at the ref. They're constantly sort of pushing the boundaries and the rules of the game, and it makes for a sort of a frustrating evening when you're playing against that. We've experienced it before in playing some teams that would just frustrate you constantly at the ref, constantly at you. But like you said, United done really well to come back in the game at the weekend. I was watching it and I thought they were struggling up until he made the substitutions and Fred came on, and Alanga, and he changed the game, and he seems to be making, Rangnick seems to be making these decisions that probably, you know, like taking Pogba off is a big decision because everybody talks about it, but it turns out to be the right decision because Fred comes on and makes an impact in the game. Atletico looking like they might be without Griezmann and Carrasco. There was talk of Suarez being out as well, so they're not going to be firing on all cylinders, so they're not going to have a lot of attacking power, which means that they're going to probably sit behind the ball and try and stifle it and look to counter-attack United.
Mark, changing the subject slightly, but seeing as Graham did touch on Ralph taking Pogba off there, what are the chances of PSG finally letting Mbappe take the penalties? We saw Messi missing last week, Neymar missed this week. Can you have a chat with someone over there?
It's been really bothering you, Ruby.
Well, Mbappe missed his last one as well, blazed it over the bar. So all three of the Paris Saint-Germain superstars, the last penalty they've taken, they've all missed them. Maybe they should let one of the less glamorous players sort of step up, because you certainly wouldn't want to take another one like Neymar did at the weekend when he did that Paul Pogba sort of stuttered run-up and then rolled it straight to the goalkeeper who barely had to move to save it. So Messi's record isn't the best. Mbappe's isn't. If you remember, he missed that penalty as well in the Euro. So I'm not sure I'd trust any of the three of them actually to take penalties. Maybe they need to leave it to somebody like Verratti or Marquinhos or somebody like that who can, not as glamorous, but maybe better from 12 yards.
Graham, I think you jumped in there. Was it a centre-back you were suggesting to take the penalties, was it?
Listen, Ruby, my penalty record isn't great neither, so I'd probably just... I wouldn't be picking a penalty kicker anyway.
As to me, anyway, not or did beat Paris Saint-Germain 3-1. Aubameyang, Mark, he got opened his tally for Barcelona the weekend with a hat-trick even.
He did, yeah. 4-1 victory away to Valencia. His first two goals, particularly the first one, was, I suppose, more classic Aubameyang, really, where there's space in behind, gets the through ball, and you know, that is one of his major strengths. The third goal, it's a I'm not sure he deserved it. Pedri had a shot from about 25 yards. Aubameyang ducked out of the way of the shot. It flicked off his back, looped over the goalkeeper into the net. It was initially given to Pedri, and Pedri was the one that celebrated it. But afterwards, the kind of official stats gave it to Aubameyang. He needed the goals. He hadn't started great. I think he was maybe lacking a bit of rhythm, a bit of fitness. Hadn't played much for Arsenal for the last few months. But hopefully, for his sake, now he's got those goals, he's sort of up and running. And they've got a really big game against Napoli in the Europa League on Thursday. And, you know, they'll need him and Ferran Torres and all the rest of them to be really on top form to go through.
Mark, we are going to say goodbye to you now. Thank you so much for joining us. We are turning our attention now to the League of Ireland and the action over the weekend. Graham, we spent a lot of last week talking about Damien Duff and the impact that he was going to have. Unfortunately, it didn't really go to plan. They suffered a heavy enough 3-0 defeat to Shelburne. He said afterwards there were a lot of positives that he's going to take out of it, but just from watching and listening to him over the last while, I'd say he'd take it fairly hard now losing.
I think, yeah, when you're coaching or managing a team and you lose, it does hit you hard because you feel, obviously, you're responsible for it, and that feeling doesn't go away quickly, so you sort of want the next game to come around so you can right a few wrongs in it. There was a sellout crowd at Talca Park. It was fantastic. I was only talking about it today. Derry Dundalk was a massive crowd. Rovers had 5,500 there as well. The atmosphere around the grounds and the hunger for the games is brilliant to see. It really is. And like you said, Damien's played his part in bringing that attention to the league as well. I also think the narratives around the Derry Dundalk game with the players moving between them, Pat's obviously going to Shells with Damien there, and Rovers' first game in the home campaign as champions as well brought a lot of people out. But it was a terrible night, and to get them crowds on that on such a terrible evening to go and watch League of Ireland football is brilliant, and it's only a positive for the League of Ireland moving forward.
It most certainly is a positive. But going back to Damien Duff and Shelburne, to the negative, they obviously had this famous pre-season we've all been hearing about, but like, they got beaten 3-0. Was it a fair reflection on the scoreline, or are Shelburne closer to the Premier League than maybe they showed at the weekend?
I don't think it's a fair result. Results are results. I think Pats were a lot more clinical. I think Shelburne, the first two goals were mistakes. The playing square passes, one across, and then Darragh Burns picks it up and hits an unbelievable goal. It's probably up there his goal of the weekend. So that's just naivety of playing for a first division team coming up. There's still players that probably aren't used to the Premier Division, although a lot of them have played in it. But it's just maybe the excitement or the adrenaline of the game or the night that's in it, and all the furore around Damien's first game and stuff might have added to that. But I thought it was a little bit closer than the result showed, but I just think Pats were a little bit more clinical at the front line, and the mistakes that Shells made were punished by Pats because of that. So it's something that Damien's probably will learn from in terms of turnovers and the reactions and the transitions of the team to giving the ball away in certain areas, make sure that they're a bit more positive, and because the lad's breaking out of the back line and then turns and tries to pass to a full back or a wing back. That's where they'd probably be saying, listen, we're out, we don't need to go back in, and they cough up a goal. But listen, it's a tough game. They're away to Drogheda now on Friday. Drogheda didn't have a game at the weekend because it was cancelled due to weather. They were due to go up to Finn Harp. So that's their first home game. So there'll be a big crowd in the United Park. So that game becomes a little bit tougher. But obviously Shells are thinking, well, we have a competitive game under our belt, and maybe they feel that they can go there and get a result.
Good win for Shamrock Rovers over UCD. But the only question that's on my mind, Graham, and you probably won't be able to answer it.
Go on.
How is Stephen Bradley going to keep all those players happy? Because looking at the bench, looking at the starting 11, like, they are players that want to play and will, like, they're good enough to be playing, but it's just really hard to get into that starting team.
Yeah, it is, but you have to earn it as well. That's the thing. And Stephen keeps them happy by keeping an edge to training and keeping an edge to the games. And if you're performing and you're training hard, you play, you earn your right to play. And if they're saying, why am I in the team? Stephen can give them a good explanation. He's back-to-back league champion, so he can... I think when he sits them down and explains it to them, they'll understand. And especially when the European game comes around and all the fixtures that happen over June and July, some of them will probably be looking for a break. But It's his job to manage them. That's why he brought them in. That's why they're at top club. They've get, like you said, they're away to Derry at the on Friday, and then they have a game at home on Monday. So they're gonna get a lot of game time in them games. But I'd rather have that headache.
I'd say everyone would. Obviously, Dundalk Derry was the other game. You said there was an edge to it, owing to personnel moving from Dundalk to Derry and a little bit vice versa. But was the game as tit for tat as the scoreline? Dundalk scored, Derry equalised. Dundalk scored, Derry equalised.
Yeah, it was a to and fro game. I thought both teams sort of went at each other in a way, and then there was a couple of. I'm not sure if Derry felt aggrieved that there was a late penalty shout or one of the a disallowed goal or something in one of the games as well. That, but again, like for an opening night game, it was like all that game could have been on the telly as well. I know Pats and Shells was on, but that game was a cracker of a game. And in fairness, Derry are hoping to probably kick on this season and put a title challenge in. They've had a lot of investment. They've invested really well in the squad. Rory Higgins is a good up-and-coming young manager. He worked with the Ireland squad under Stephen Kenny. Stephen O'Donnell going back to Dundalk has got a lot of loan signings in. And the likes of Stephen Bradley, who scored the goal for Dundalk, looks really exciting. Obviously, they lost Mark Duffy, who went up to Derry. So they've brought in a lot of loan players, which will take a while to settle as well. But they look like they're going to have a go this season as well, which is good to see.
It's great now that game will be on Friday night, Derry City and Shamrock Rovers, because I think
that's on RT as well.
Yeah, it's on RT. We'll learn a lot from that. We're going to take a very quick break, but first of all, Ruby, I just want to put something to you. Ryan O'Connor has tweeted us, and he said around this time last year, Ruby tipped up Galopin Deschamps for Cheltenham. Ryan's wondering, are we going to be having a chat about Cheltenham? We absolutely will be closer to the time. But yesterday, Ruby, you mentioned a horse that we should keep an eye on. And of course, as expected, I didn't write it down or remember it. But you might tell Ryan again what it is. You don't remember either.
I don't remember either. I remember Galopin Deschamps. Of course, he remembers Galopin Deschamps last year. He was 25-1.
Ryan, Ruby did tell us to take note of a horse that won over the weekend that he mentioned at the top of yesterday's show. So it's worth going back and listening to it.
I will think back when we come back from the break. I will have the answer. Catch me on the hop, Marie. You're not supposed to do that.
Right. Well, I thought you'd remember. It is your specialist subject. Right, let's take a break.
RTE.
2FM.
Game on.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on. On 2FM.
Now, Ruby, do you remember?
Marie, I'm sitting here thinking Goshen, Mellon, Fakir Dudairy, Hillcrest, Tihupu. I can list them out every horse that won on the weekend, and I can't remember which one I said sticking it up for Cheltenham, because I didn't see anything
Hillcrest
at the weekend that I thought would win at Cheltenham.
You said Hillcrest.
Possibly, yeah. I had to review it again this morning. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, you tell me to stick a lot of things in my notebook for Cheltenham, because you know that I need to stick a lot of things in my notebook for Cheltenham, so there you go.
Because I know you never do.
I remember the notebook Cheltenham bit.
Yeah,
I just didn't remember the horse.
He is a fine horse, but I looked at it again this morning and I'm not so sure.
Okay, well, if Ryan is listening, there you go. Don't bother putting Hillcrest in your notebook for Cheltenham until Ruby comes back to us. Okay, let us now talk about Kelly Harrington. She was back in the ring today in Sofia and seemed to win very, very comfortably. Gavin Casey of the 42 is with us. Gavin, it's good to see you back.
Yeah, it really was. It's been a long time. It's hard to believe, really, that Harrington hasn't boxed competitively since Tokyo on that famous day. And you're right, it was pretty comfortable against Agnes Alexisson, a Swede who she beat today via unanimous decision. She won on four judges' cards, 30-27, i.e. every round. And then one judge had it slightly closer. But she fought Alexisson as well in the European Games semi-final in 2019 and beat her reasonably handily then as well before having to withdraw from the final. So, kind of an expected victory at a tournament called the Stranja Tournament, Marie, which is in Sofia in Bulgaria. It takes place every year. It wouldn't be considered a major tournament per se. And by major, I mean akin to, say, a Grand Slam in tennis or a major in golf. But it is a tournament that carries a lot of prestige. It's one that allows fighters to kind of gear their preparation towards peaking at major tournaments. And we have a Women's World Championships on the horizon, as well as a Men's European Championships, both coming up in May. So a nice little pit stop for the Irish team and a great start for Kelly.
She is a bit like Queens before Wimbledon.
Yeah, it's very like that, Ruby. Like, you know yourself. I mean, all everybody in studio with Marie, your footballing prowess as well. Elite sports people, like, you have to maintain a certain level of excellence, but it is about peaking at the right time, isn't it? And this is a nice little, it's an opportunity as well for the younger fighters to get exposed to elite level competition. And actually, the Stranger tournament is almost harder to medal at than some of the major tournaments because you only have the superpowers involved in it. It's a kind of an invitational, if you like. So it's your Eastern European countries, big boxing countries that you're competing against. So Keddy would be expected to medal, but any other Irish boxer who did medal, it would be a huge bonus.
Who else should we be keeping an eye out for then?
Well, we've lost a good few, Marie. Day one, we had three defeats. Yesterday was a little bit better. We had a nice hat-trick for the Belfast women. Caitlin Fryers opened Ireland's account with a unanimous decision win against Romania's Eugenia Ankel at 50 kg. Carly McNall, also from Belfast, threw on a 4-1 split. And then Michaela Walsh, who people will be familiar with from Tokyo. Similar boat to Kelly, back in competitive action for the first time and clean through with the unanimous win against Romania. A couple more to come as well.
Gav, I have some bad news for you now. I've got my tickets for Keddy Taylor and I've booked my flight and I plan on hanging on your coattails over there for the weekend. So it's going to be very hard to shake me because I have never gone to anything like this before. So I'll need you to show me the way.
It won't be a problem. I'll show you the way to Jimmy's Corner by Times Square. We can have a few chats. I'm really looking forward to that as well. Big Bellator card as well while we're talking about female fighters. Friday night, Bellator 275. MMA is kind of outside my wheelhouse, but you have the biggest Irish female fight of all time there. Leah McQuart against Sinead Kavanagh. I think both of them have been on the show quite recently, so one for people to look out for.
That's for sure, Gav. Thank you so much, as always. So that is all we have time for. Graham, thank you for coming into studio. Ruby, drive safely home from Navan.
I'm just wondering how I missed the invitation to Katie
York. That's what I was thinking.
I just wondered where the memo was. I didn't quite see it. I wonder if Roland, our producer, got one.
Okay,
well,
we're out of time now. Tara Kumar is up next.
RTE 2FM. Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken and turkey is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.